Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. A gloomy day out there in parts of Vermont, but we won't be as gloomy here when we talk about various subjects today. But there is a major subject that I want to spend the bulk of today's program on, and that's healthcare. Healthcare has been in the news lately on a national level because healthcare insurers are starting to pull out of the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, those exchanges in various states. And in Vermont, just the last few weeks, the Green Mountain Care Board has been reviewing hospital budgets and insurer rates. And it'll be determined where they go with that. Healthcare costs, access, the quality of our healthcare are a major concern of all Vermonters. And it is a major, major part of our state's economy. And so on occasion over the next few months, what I want to do is focus on health care issues. One day, have a really intense focus on health care. Today, we'll begin that discussion with Senator Tim Ash. He's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. It's his committee that oversees health care in Vermont. And we'll leave significant time for your opinions, because this is a very important topic. Healthcare touches us all. And whether it's we're talking about affordability, whether we're talking about access, whether we're talking about the quality of healthcare that we receive, it is a major issue in our life. And then we'll check in with Bob Ney at Talk Media News. Trump's headed to Mexico. We'll find out why. His speech tonight, we'll find out what he's changing. And last night's primary results. We had primary results in Arizona and Florida. Some interesting incumbents were trying to retain their job. Did they? And then Hillary's continued email problems. We heard about this at the top of the news. The FBI is thinking of releasing, and reports are, CNN is reporting that they are going to release their report, their notes on the interview with Hillary Clinton that they had when they concluded that they were not going to prosecute her on her email, her private server, and the emails on that private server. But first, let me set up our discussion today about healthcare with some background, and I think it's important to do. On a national level, insurers are beginning to pull out of the affordable care marketplace. Those in some states, those exchanges where private insurers, you have an option of going to one insurer or another in those exchanges. And the reason they're pulling out is that insurers need healthy people to buy insurance to offset the cost of covering those that are sicker. And the problem is that healthy people are not signing up in these exchanges at the rates that the insurers thought, because, and most analysts are saying, because of the cost of the insurance in these exchanges. And as a result, health insurers are pulling out of this marketplace in Arizona, in North Carolina, in Kentucky in particular. In Vermont, the future of our healthcare system has been the subject of much debate, tremendous debate over the last few years. And one of the things I think we sometimes try to do in this debate is we try to simplify the complex. We often overstate the benefits. And in our debates, sometimes we even ignore the disadvantages of a particular program. And this is a problem because it leads Vermonters to be doubtful about any sort of health care plans or health care changes that are coming. And what we have seen is that there's been disappointment from Vermonters. There's been disappointment. The results have been disappointing, and in many cases, they've been costly. Let me give you just two examples of what we've done lately. We put tremendous effort into this single-payer effort in order to research it because Governor Shumlin said he was going to implement a single-payer system. But after years of promoting and promising a single-payer system, the results would be that implementing a single-payer system would crush the state's economy. A lot of people knew that, but it took years to sort of come to that conclusion. And similarly, with the health care insurance exchange here in Vermont called Vermont Health Connect, it was built on a promise that it would reduce health insurance costs. But that hasn't happened either. And Vermonters are frustrated, not only at the cost of running that program, which is, you know, over $200 million, and it's taken years longer than promised to build, and it's still not working properly. What they want, as I said before, are three things. They want access, they want quality, and they want affordability. And by the way, Vermont, I would say, does very well in delivering health quality care. And our system offers almost universal coverage. I mean, somewhere in the range of 96% of Vermonters are covered with health care insurance. That's not the case in all states. But achieving affordability and cost containment is the real issue in Vermont. And at all levels, from healthcare providers to government and government regulators, there has been a failure to really achieve true cost containment that brings down healthcare costs for Vermonters. In fact, and I'll talk about this a little bit with Tim Ash. In fact, some think government regulation is a problem and not a solution because regulators are too lax or too cozy with the healthcare institutions. So what have we done over the last few years? We've implemented what is called a blueprint for health that addresses chronic diseases that drive about 80% of healthcare costs. And this is a good long-term strategy because it does management prevention on heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. But it's a long-term strategy. It doesn't address the immediate needs of lowering the cost of care for Vermonters right now. And in his final speech, budget speech, Governor Shumlin promoted the all-payer model as a method for containing costs. And just let me sort of explain this because we're going to be talking about this later with Senator Tim Ash. An all-payer model changes the way doctors and other providers are paid. What it does, it goes from the current system where payments are aligned with services. It goes from the current system where you just, it's fee for service. And the payments are aligned with services to focus on outcomes. We're moving away from the current fee-for-service system where providers are paid or reimbursed for the service they provide to one that would give a global budget and require our healthcare providers to manage the health of their population to that budget number. And although the all-payer model may over time realign more closely to our overall healthcare goals, what we got to be careful about in this is not to oversell the benefits. It won't be the Golden Goose. It will not be the sole mechanism to use to keep healthcare costs in check. If that is the sole solution, it's not going to work. And as we're doing this, look at our healthcare system out there right now. We're driving to a monolithic system. And whether it's a monopoly or a monolithic system, aren't the outcomes the same? Monopolies, whether in the private or public sector, they have rather a dismal record of controlling costs. And in the absence of competition, whether a monopoly or a monolith, too often both are bloated, bureaucratic, uninspired, and slow to modify or innovate their business. So where are we headed? That's the question that we're going to discuss over the course of the next 2 to 4 months. Where are we headed with our healthcare system? One thing's certain. The drive to consolidate medical practices and institutions in this state is going on. But is it going to control our ever-growing healthcare costs? In a moment, we'll discuss all of this with Senator Tim Ash, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, the committee that's responsible for healthcare in the state Senate. But I wanted to take some time and set up some of the issues we're going to be talking about. Consolidation of hospitals, consolidation of medical practices, cost of the system, access to the system, and the quality of care in the system. And now we'll get into specifics when Senator Tim Ash joins us. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It is my pleasure to have in our WDEV studios State Senator Tim Ash, Chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Mike.
Let me sort of ask a broad question, and then we'll sort of get into the nuts and bolts of this, because there's so many complicating aspects when we discuss healthcare. But let me ask this sort of broad question, and you take it wherever you want to go. Where are we going with healthcare in Vermont?
Well, you've asked a difficult question. If you asked 100 people in Montpelier, they'd probably give you 100 different answers to that one. First off, I'd say that much will depend upon the new governor and his or her team. It's been a little unusual because I've heard not really a word from either major candidate at this point about what their vision is for the state's healthcare system. We hear a little bit about Vermont Health Connect, but as frustrating as that's been, that really has little to do with the grand picture moving forward in terms of spending and access and all the issues you discussed as you set this topic up. But I think there's really two primary things that all people would agree are part of the landscape, for better or worse. The first is the all-payer model, as you described it. And your listeners, if they're driving, might want to turn the volume up to stop from falling asleep for a moment. The all-payer model is basically getting a guaranteed payment from the federal government and then granting the state some flexibility in how it can pay providers for providing services as long as they meet quality expectations. The reason the state has been pursuing this, and when I say the state, I mean the Shumlin administration and the Green Mountain Care Board, is that they believe that it will provide predictability in terms of how much money comes from the feds, and then allow the state to start to transition to a method of paying that's not fee-for-service but actually pays people to just keep people healthy and gives them incentives to do that. The second piece is one that's a personal interest of mine, which is a focus on cost reduction. It receives very little fanfare, unfortunately, and especially in light of the fact that it's the fastest growing part of our economy and it's crushing everything in its path. But that takes difficult forms. That's asking hospitals to better understand their costs, so that they can manage them down. It's asking providers not to perform unnecessary procedures or prescribe drugs that are perhaps unnecessary or in quantities that are unnecessary. Those are all things that add cost to Vermonters. So on the big picture, the policy side, that all-payer model is the big issue. My sense is that we will know before January whether the federal government and the state have reached some kind of interim agreement on the cost issue. That should be a never-ending pursuit.
I want to come back to both of those issues in a moment, but I want to sort of lay out a broader issue too. And that is sort of the false promise. I mean, promising on the Vermont Health Connect, the promise of lower health care costs that didn't happen. Maybe it slowed some of the growth, but not a lot of the growth in that. The actual cost of setting up the health care exchange, sort of the disappointment in promising a single payer and not delivering a single payer. So now we talk about all payer, and we talk about all these other things. Why should Vermonters believe us when we talk about things that are happening that will help them in that three stools, the cost, the quality, and accessibility?
Well, the first thing is it's important to remember that prior to Governor Shumlin taking office, it is not like the healthcare landscape was all roses. Costs were going up in double digits every single year. People were not happy. Businesses complained, and they weren't just focusing on governments at the time. They were also had in their scope insurance industry for unsustainable cost, particularly on business, but increasingly at the time in government. So for all the frustration people have felt over the last 6 years, it's not like it was out of the blue. This was a problem before Governor Shumlin came in. I've actually found it somewhat interesting that Governor Shumlin, yes, it's true that in political campaigns he, to use your word, promised that he would do single payer. In the end, that he reached a conclusion that it would be problematic for the economy, as you noted in your earlier segment. There should be some sense that that was a mature decision to make, rather than to go full steam ahead just because he promised it. So the fact that it took a few years to get to the point where the plug was pulled is frustrating. It makes people wonder what was really going on, or if it was being strung along for political purposes. But in the end, if it was the right decision, people should be happy that the wise, cautious approach was taken. But now I look and I say, well, people have to remember what the real problem here is. It's not so simple to say that government is just screwing everything up and therefore you're spending a lot on healthcare. The real issue goes way beyond that, to talk about the price of pharmaceuticals, medical devices, the growth in the physical infrastructure of our Vermont hospitals, which keeps going unabated. It is the proliferation of drug prescribing all across the state in ways that have previously been unthinkable. Those are issues, some of which we can control, some are for Congress to control. And I just want to make that clear. We're all in this, in a sense, together, but it's not because government is jacking up prices that we face huge health care pressures. It's because the private sector is doing that, and we have to figure out the right relationship in managing those expenses. I think a new administration is key to rebuilding the trust that you speak about. I think people are fatigued with the current administration. Even when they do something that's right, it gets ignored. And then when something goes bad, it colors everything that they touch. So a new administration really is key, and my hope is that voters and taxpayers will look to the new governor and his or her team and really expect a robust, smart strategy that tries to not get a Hail Mary touchdown on the first play of the game, but rather maybe looks for a few first downs to build confidence moving forward.
You hit on something I want to talk about in terms cost containment, as you said, is the key in this entire debate. But I want to ask this question. Do monolithic sort of healthcare systems inspire cost containment?
Well, the evidence suggests it does not. Any monopoly that isn't regulated with a very heavy hand will always have the type of bloat and fat in their budgets that you described earlier, and I believe that very strongly. Even the Obama administration has increasingly been sending out bulletins and issuing opinions suggesting that the acquisition of independent practices by hospital networks is a problem in terms of cost and innovation, that the consolidation of hospital networks across the country has been a problem in terms of cost containment and innovation. So it really is an issue. Now, we have one large medical network in the state, UVM Medical Center. In addition to Central Vermont Medical Center, they're likely to be in an affiliation agreement in the near future with Porter in Middlebury. And they do wonderful things, and I think Dr. Brumstead has a vision for healthcare in the state, which is very commendable. But the same would be true of Green Mountain Power, which has a monopoly for electric retail sales in large parts of the state. It relies upon a strong regulatory framework to make sure that we're not allowing costs to get out of control.
One of the things that I'm curious about is government a problem? Are regulators too cozy with the healthcare system?
Well, I think that the real problem is that it's an industry, not just in Vermont but nationwide, which has been so slow to change or to ever believe that they should have to tighten their own belts, that there is a perception amongst everybody from the Obama administration on down to Vermont regulators and other states is that you have to entice the industry with financial incentives to do things that the public thinks they should be doing anyways. And so here at our own Green Mountain Care Board have generally taken the view that we need all the players in the healthcare landscape to join forces to make the kind of positive changes happen. Well, that's more costly than regulating them with a tough hand.
Would single payer be any different?
Single payer has a theoretical promise of reduced administrative complexity. One of the reasons the Shumlin administration reached the conclusion it would not work in Vermont is that it was never truly going to be a single payer. There still would have been many insurance products that were payers in the Vermont context, whether it was different elements of the federal government, like the VA, whether it was people who have insurance through large multi-state plans because they're an employer like a GE that are in multiple states, there still would have been considerable complexity as the provider community had to deal with this multitude of payers. So a single payer model, if we were in another country where they started 100 years ago with a completely different way of approaching health insurance and health care access, it's hard to translate that into a very complex, mature non-system that we've developed here in the United States.
We're speaking with Senator Tim Ash, who is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. And the reason we're talking with Senator Ash is because the Senate Finance Committee does all things healthcare, most things healthcare, in the Senate, at least the financing aspect of it. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Give us a call if you have a comment or an opinion. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, you're on open mic with Senator Tim Ash.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, whether we go with a single payer or multiple provider system, you keep coming back to that big problem of cost containment. And obviously more expensive and innovative methods of dealing with illness come along on a weekly basis, and we can't afford to necessarily provide these for everybody in a system. I think we need to focus on a system that is going to provide everything at that level of 100% provision on things that are medically necessary. And we have branched out over the last few years into mandatory contraception with no copay, paying for gender reassignment surgery, which can be tremendously expensive. And then the big thing that's breaking the camel's back now is addiction-related treatments. Multiple trips to rehab by people that have no intention of curbing their drug use, ordered there by a judge as an alternative to jail. These are the things that are breaking the back of our current system right now. I mean, even you could argue that maternity-related things are not medically necessary. It's a choice. And that perhaps we would need to have a higher system of copays for some things than others. For instance, maternity-related things. Childbearing is a choice and not medically necessary. So perhaps people who choose to engage in childbearing should have to pay a higher percentage of that cost and not have it be 100% covered.
Rich, I want to sort of, you bring up a lot of good issues here, and one of the things I want to sort of redirect that question, because it was on my list to ask, is that the Washington Post probably said it best when it was railing against Bernie Sanders' Medicaid for All. They said, these systems require authoritative authority to tell patients they can't have everything they want. Politicians aren't very good in saying no to expanded health care. How do we contain cost if we don't say no?
Well, that's a somewhat oversimplified question, Mike. You know, federal and state-funded programs aren't totally free buffets of health services. There are limits on what people can access. Maybe there are around the edges decisions that politicians could pull back from. There are probably other areas that we don't wisely spend and invest in. So it's probably a bit of push and pull there. But I'm not my eyes aren't covered when it comes to knowing this. The one of the issues that we hear from providers sometimes is those providers who serve Medicaid patients, just as an example, sometimes are frustrated when there's no shows, but there's no financial consequence to the person who doesn't show as a result. The 15-minute or 30-minute slot at that provider's practice has been booked, and then no one shows, so there's no money coming in. So issues like that are certainly worth exploring to make sure that we've got a fair system. I think, challenge Rich, who just called, about what the real drivers are. You know, I think whether it's the opiate addiction issue, there's a case to be made, quite the opposite of Rich's contention, which is that actually getting people into treatment might be financially beneficial to the state to get a handle on that and try and turn people's lives around, those who want to turn their lives around. Maternity and other issues, be careful what you wish for. If you don't provide good maternal care and then you have children who have all sorts of health issues because the parent didn't get the right care at the right time, we'll probably be taking care of that kid with all sorts of medical conditions for many years to come. So some of it is a question of values and what the state wants to invest in our people. But I chafe a bit when I hear people obsess about the one or two micro issues that they think are the real problem, and then I don't hear them talk about drug companies. Mm-hmm. If anyone wants to talk about who the real culprits are here, we should focus where the big drivers are. And the big drivers, it's not the one person who decides to have a second kid. It's the people at AstraZeneca and a whole bunch of other companies who keep jacking up prices.
And that's where I was going with sort of setting this up. Cost containment. And we're still focused on cost containment. What are some of the things that you think we need to go after?
Well, I think if I could have a magic wand and produce one wish, it's that every hospital in Vermont would actually know the costs. And that seems like a simple statement. Most hospitals do not know what their costs are to provide any service. The billing and the charges the customers pay are completely divorced from the actual costs incurred by the hospital to provide those services. So when we talk even about an all-payer agreement or global budgets and so on, you still cannot properly manage your expenses if you don't know what it costs you to provide a single service. And I'll give you a simple example. We had a CEO of a medical system in Utah speak to our committee about this time last year. She had a number of orthopedic surgeons on her staff, and they looked to see how much each of the orthopedic surgeons cost to provide a knee replacement. Well, it turned out there was great variability. It was the first time anyone had ever looked to see how much it cost Dr. X and Dr. Y to perform these services. Once they knew the actual cost, they were able to understand what was driving Dr. Y's 1.5 times cost, and then they were able to do something about it. They wound up reducing the amount of expense in their orthopedic unit, not slowing the rate of growth. They actually reduced the absolute dollar amounts spent. So to me, that is almost like a fundamental foundational question. If you don't know your costs, how can you manage to them? So that would, to me, be the single most important thing we could do. We'll get a lot of pushback and say that it's too much effort and it's going to cost a lot of money, but to me, the payoff down the road would be huge.
I want to come back to access in a moment, but I want to sort of go to the phone lines because they've lit up. Let's go to Rick in Shelburne. Rick, you're on open mic with Senator Tim Ash.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with your guest. I'm actively involved in healthcare. I'm on the front line, and the one component that I never hear being discussed, you talk about pharmaceuticals being the problem. How about patient responsibility? We see poor choices being made every day. We have COPDers who come in and really abuse our healthcare system because they continue to smoke. They have money for cigarettes, but not for their inhalers. We see diabetics. Morbid obesity is at record levels. There's no personal responsibility for poor choices in diet and lifestyles. It leads to diabetes. It leads to cardiac issues. It is killing the system. And there's no talk of personal responsibility. And I'd like to hear what your feelings are.
Rick, great question. Thank you for the phone call.
Well, no, it is a critical question. You know, I could wax poetic about how we need to have a society that provides meaningful economic opportunities to people and jobs in a way that probably would reduce many of those factors. But that's obviously a long-term vision and requires major changes throughout our society. When it comes to our healthcare industry, certainly, as Mike was talking about, the Blueprint for Health and the Chronic Disease Initiative, where we try and manage those people who are really the small percentage but super high-cost individuals to our system, both on the commercial and public insurance systems. I think our providers really do need to be more aggressive in working with policymakers to determine how we could do something about that problem. Much of this is a doctor-patient relationship issue. But not all of it. There are financial incentives, both incentives and penalties, that probably have a role to play in making sure that some of the people turn their situations around.
Let's go back to the phone lines, and let's go to Liz in Ferrisburg. Liz, thanks for joining us this morning, Senators Tim Ash and myself on open mic.
Good morning. I want to first say that I totally support universal health care. I think it's the only way to make health care affordable. I just want the health care that our legislators, our federal legislators have. Just make it all that. We figured it out for them, figure it out for us. And it shouldn't be that hard. We have so many models to choose from, both in the European countries and in our own country. We have states that have done it. So I think we're just making this so much harder than it has to be. But I want to say this summer I had a horse accident. I ended up with a traumatic brain injury, and I'm recovering from. And I had the best health care at the University of Vermont. But there were two things, and I don't know where to go with this. And now, Tim Ash, maybe you can tell me how maybe I talked to Harry Chen. I don't know. But one of the things that I was constantly asked, because of this injury, they supposed that I had headaches, which I didn't have. And I continued to tell the nursing staff and the doctors that I don't have headaches. And I was pleased that they asked me, do you have a headache? And I would say no. Well, just remember, they would say. And I would probably say 30 times, just remember, you have Oxycontin if you have a headache. Why would they say that to me? Tylenol, if I did have a headache, should be the first line of defense. I was continually reminded that I could have Oxycontin. I cannot understand, with all that we're talking about, heroin addiction and addiction and Oxycontin, why it would always be front and foremost to tell me that I had this prescription. And I know you can't answer the question, but I'd love to share this with somebody to say, stop.
Liz, thank you for your phone call. Liz brings up a really good point here. Are we over-prescribing narcotics?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. I think the medical profession was trained for many, many years in the spirit of no pain, meaning that you're a patient that comes in with some type of acute issue or chronic issue, and they were trained to use pharmaceuticals to alleviate your pain, to make it go away. And it's only in recent years, as people have seen how addictive many of these drugs are, that people are thinking, well, maybe some pain threshold is appropriate so the patient gets used to a road to recovery that is drug-free. So that's a slow cultural shift which is occurring right now. The legislature didn't want to micromanage how a doctor handles each patient relationship, but has asked the Department of Health, working with providers, to start thinking of best practices in terms of prescribing opiates. I had my own episode in a soccer injury several years ago, and the surgeon was actually very good, sent me home with a jar full of oxycodone and said, take it if you're in any pain. Well, I wasn't in any pain, so I probably didn't need the whole month's supply. And then once I was well past recovered, the jar was still sitting in my house. So not only did someone pay for those pills that were never used, but then they're just lying out there waiting for someone with a problem to stumble upon them. Now, luckily, I've returned them to one of the safe disposal sites. But the question is a really good one about why we're so slow to start moving towards other pain management efforts.
One of the things that I think callers will agree on, the audience will agree on, perhaps we all agree on, is universal health care. But the debate is often, how do we get there? What method do we use to get there? Do we get there with a single payer? Do we get there through the insurance companies? How do we get there? How do we get there?
Well, one perhaps way of restating the question is, are we already there? And what we have right now is basically universal coverage. It's just inefficient. And some people don't know how to properly access the care, or there are hurdles for them. So let's take primary care as an example. Throughout the state, there are federally qualified health centers and various health clinics in communities. There is a network that if it would saturate a Vermont map if you were to look at it. And any person can walk into any one of these facilities and pay on a sliding scale basis if they don't have insurance. They take all types of insurance, and you will get very high quality primary health care. I have not had insurance in my adult life, and I went to my community health center in Burlington. I've had insurance. I go to the same place. So in terms of primary care, we really do have the infrastructure in place to provide primary care to every person in Vermont. Most people have it in a formal sense because they hold an insurance card, and those who don't could access it at very affordable prices. So it's not perfect, and it is an inefficient way, and not everyone is educated to that availability. But it's there. We need to be more thoughtful about how we communicate to people that it exists. The insurance itself, as you point out, we're more than 96% insured with formal insurance. Some portion of those who are in that 4% or so uninsured are what we call the churners. You know, they're people who have just moved into the state, or they've just left a job and they're about to move. So some percentage of those, it's really not a problem that policymakers maybe want to put at the top of the list. And then there's a small handful of people who still have no insurance whatsoever. Not all those people are poor. The very poorest people generally gravitate to Medicaid through some manner. There are people who have middle class and above incomes, and it's about a fourth or so of those who are uninsured who are just choosing not to have insurance. They probably think that I'm a hero. I don't get hurt. I don't get sick. And if I do, I'll just pay as I go.
I want to come back to this access issue that you raise in terms of primary care doctors. But first, I want to try to get to everybody's phone calls. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, you know, the reason why we have an economic problem with the healthcare cost is because the healthcare was taken out of the marketplace, and the theory is the free market will set floors and ceilings. In 1942, Henry Kaiser and the federal government removed healthcare from the marketplace by saying, I'll pay for your healthcare, it's not going to cost you a dime. And if it doesn't cost you a dime, you don't care how much the healthcare costs, you're going to go to the doctor for any of those things, they're not going to cost you anything. And then Henry Kaiser was compensated because he didn't have to pay taxes on the benefit, and the patient didn't have to pay taxes on the benefit either.
Fred, thank you for your phone call. I guess what Fred's talking about is that sort of predates insurance, is what he's talking about. And I'm going to sort of take liberty with Fred's question, because I think it has a grain of something I want to go after here, is that once you do take people out of the sort of the marketplace and put insurance in front of them, do they have a concern about maybe being a little bit rational about their health care choices?
Well, I mean, the first response to Fred is that many of his neighbors in Newbury back in 1941 had no health coverage whatsoever and were likely to die at a young age, had poor dental health, amongst other maladies. And so the insurance marketplace might not be perfect, but for people in rural Vermont in particular, let's just say that things are better today for them than they would have been back before Mr. Kaiser. But there is a behavioral component to health insurance, which makes it more likely that you will go get services even if you're on the edge of really needing them, because you know that the cost barriers aren't there. That is a feature of public and private insurance systems, and it's not a question of whether we should have private insurance and public health insurance programs. It's how should they properly be structured so that we're doing as much as we can to encourage people to live healthy lifestyles, but then get the care when they need it. That's the whole point of insurance. And we're not perfect. Vermont can't expect to be perfect because no other state and no other country is perfect. So it's really, that's a battle that never ends, is trying to get that sweet spot.
Let's go to Chris in Waterbury. Chris, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike, and good morning to Mr. Ash.
Good morning.
Sitting here listening to your conversation, it's frustrating to hear everything that's going on about your solutions. I agree with the gentleman there a couple calls back that talked about the responsibility aspect of it. You talk about our chronic diseases being one of the number one issues, and if you look at our obesity rate in the state, it's tremendous, and it's not getting any better, and there's something that's got to be done to actually force people to become more responsible. So you had a gal that just called in and talked about the opiate issue. I'm going to one-up her. I went down to the medical doctors there the other day, and I desperately try to stay away from them because I don't have a lot of faith in them, but I had some bad sunburn on my legs, and I was worried about infection. When I went in to have my legs looked at, the doctor, young guy, was more concerned about the fact that I hadn't had a tetanus shot in a while than my legs. And so much so that he persisted on the fact that perhaps I have another tetanus shot. And I finally got tired of listening to him about it, so I said, yeah, whatever, go ahead. And so the nurse came in after the doctor left and gave me the tetanus shot. And my wife was there, sitting there with me. And after she had injected me with a tetanus shot, she turned to my wife and said, oh, by the way, the whooping cough vaccination was in there as well. Well, nobody said anything to me about vaccinating me for the whooping cough. So I'm wondering just what the medical industry is all about, whether they're forcing them their own ideas and agenda on people, or whether they're there really to take care of them.
What about our medical people?
Well, I think Vermont has great medical professionals pretty much throughout the ranks, and preventative health care, including things like tetanus shots, it's not meant to be a disruption to people's lives or an inconvenience or to foist a philosophy on a patient. It's done for sound scientific and medical reasons. So are there going to be some providers who maybe push people beyond where they really want to go? That might be true. It's true in every profession. But I think as a general rule, we have a very disciplined and highly competent medical profession here in Vermont.
Let's assume that quality – Gail, I'll get to you in just a minute. Let's assume that quality – let's not debate quality. Because I think most Vermonters think that we have good quality of care in this state. And we've talked about affordability and cost containment. But more and more I'm hearing – people's access to primary care doctors, to specialists, are not being denied, but it's taking weeks, in some cases months, to get in to see a doctor. Is that a problem?
Well, it's always a problem if people can't access the care they need at the right time. the reasons for it are not so straightforward. I mean, on the one hand, we did not have a sudden influx of new medical providers while we added many people to the insurance rolls. So suddenly we have tens of thousands more people who have insurance and can get services, but we don't have more providers to handle them. So that's one issue. The other is that we hear many concerns, rightly, from people who have insurance but have big out-of-pocket costs, so they feel there's an access issue there. Well, that's not the creation of Vermont regulators. That's a problem that many, many states are facing as well. And so when you have new people with new insurance products with out-of-pocket expenses, they are right to say that they have problems accessing it. But, of course, the solution to that is more expensive, right? Providing more financial assistance is just going to add more cost to that system. The other piece is that we have providers who are often having to make difficult decisions about what type of patients they're willing to see. So Medicaid right now is the lowest payer in terms of reimbursements for services. Medicare would be next up, and then most of the commercial insurers would be on top of that. We have providers who are in areas of the state like Franklin County with a tremendously large percentage of Medicaid patients, and we saw two pediatric medical clinics shut down because Medicaid was not providing reimbursements that were high enough, and they couldn't just shift over to some commercially insured people. That access issue is extremely problematic, and so, yes, it is a problem. I was unhappy that the state officials and the Green Mountain Care Board were not seeing what was, you know, what should have been some warning signs up in Franklin County before these facilities closed, because then we find ourselves wishing that someone had rushed to the to save these two practices before going out of business and creating access issues up there. Luckily, we have put more dollars into primary care Medicaid reimbursements in our last year's budget, which will hopefully preserve access and expand it for some more people.
Let's go to Gail in Calais. Gail, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for taking my call. And I'll try to keep my comments brief. I have a lot of thoughts in my head going on. It's been a good discussion and some good comments from the callers. And one of them in particular, I agree with, it's a big issue with people not everyone, but many people not taking responsibility for their health care. And and it's not an easy fix, unfortunately. The other thing I want to comment on is my big concern is quality of care, and I'm speaking both professionally and personally about that. And personally, I am now part of One Care, and I'm also Medicare, but and I have a very good physician, but he is not able to order just basic tests, and I'm talking about complete blood study and chest x-ray, for instance, because I don't have any symptoms. It's kind of a bittersweet situation for me because I am fortunately healthy, as far as I know. And it really should be part of preventive care. For instance, some things can be diagnosed early on and treated more readily. So I am very, very concerned about, I agree with cost containment wholly, but when you when the quality of care is reduced, I have a problem with that. And I know that there are many people that disagree with me, but thank you for taking my call.
Gail, thank you. I think Gail hit the nail on the head here. There's a fine balance between cost containment and quality of care, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the word rationing is usually raised whenever governments suggest playing a more active role in healthcare service provision. But there is a distinction between saying we're going to cap the number of dollars we spend and therefore, too bad if you're the one who needs a procedure and we're out of cash. There's a difference between that and saying there are certain procedures which have no medical benefit or which do not prove to be useful to either improving someone's condition or properly diagnosing someone who might be prone to getting some type of illness or disease. And those kinds of things, I think in the past, medical practitioners have been very, on a on a sort of a social level, reluctant to say no to many patients who are insistent that they get additional services. So one part of cost containment is the willingness of a doctor to say, patient X, I'm sorry, but there is no medically sound reason that I would allow you to go through with this procedure. And that's a difficult conversation that has to happen, and it has to happen over and over again throughout the state. Most patients, all they know is they want to get the best care, they want the most services at the lowest cost, but somewhere along the line, someone's paying that bill. And if it has no medical basis, then we have to ask some hard questions about whether they should be allowed.
There is so much that I'm not going to be able to get to. The all-payer waiver, the Green Mountain Care Board, its future and its responsibilities, hospital budgets, among other things as well. Can you come back at 10:23 and stay with us until 10:50? Because we will have a lot of phone calls, and we don't have the ability to get to them right
Michael,
now.
Michael, it's a $6 billion industry, so I'd be happy to come back and spend some more time chatting with you about it.
And that's what we'll do. We'll come back to Senator Tim Ash from 10:23 to 10:50. If you have phone calls, if you would call back then, I certainly would appreciate it. It's 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. And this is a continuing series that I hope to have throughout the next 4 months running up until the legislative session, sort of an information exchange about our health care system here in Vermont. I think it's a very important part of the discussion in terms of where we're going as a state and what we're doing as a state. Coming up, Bob Ney, Talk Media News, and also, again, Senator Tim Ash will join us. We'll talk again about health care. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Can you believe that? 85 years, WDEV News Radio. We're not celebrating the past. We're celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond, and, of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Tim Ash coming up, and Bob Ney right after the break. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We, in the first hour, we had a very robust discussion about healthcare. We'll continue that discussion later on in this hour. We had a lot of phone calls. Didn't get to all of them, and I want to make sure that you have the opportunity to talk. So I've invited Senator Tim Ash back to the program about 10:23 or so. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program, a regular fave of the program here, Bob Ney. Bob, good morning.
Hi, Mike. My internet went bye-bye, so I'm sorry I'm late.
No problem. Hey, let's go through some of the issues that are in the news. There's this death of a ISIS leader that ISIS says they're gonna make sure that the people pay who killed this person. First of all, why is this person so important?
You know, he was a social he was their social network doctorate, their guru. I mean, this guy produced Hollywood level videos, horrible things they did in them, but, you know, the music, and it was all to entice people, social networking, outreaching to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people directly. So this guy knew what he was doing. He wasn't like your regular man from a cave that had never, you know, used the internet. So he was a specialty for them. I'm sure they'll find somebody else who's kind of Western educated to do it, but that's why I think they're so furious about it. They were going to retaliate on us anyway, whether we killed him or not.
I want to sort of broaden the discussion a little bit about our drone program, which has been highly effective. If I want to ask this question, Bob, because I'm just curious, and I don't want you to read anything into it. If this was a Republican president, would there be some opposition to how aggressively the drone program is being used?
Well, now the liberal community would be opposed to it. You know, if it were a Republican president, I would assume that the Republicans would go along with the drone program.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Well, I was wondering if the opposition to the drone program would be more intense, more vocal.
Oh, if it were a Republican president?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Look, the liberal element hates the drones. I mean, it's a George Bush thing, you know? And they should be absolutely protesting around the White House, disrupting meetings where the president's at, absolutely. And they don't do it. If this was a Republican president, they would be saying he should be up for war crimes.
But it's a highly effective program in terms of taking out the leadership of either Al-Qaeda, ISIS, or the Taliban.
Well, it is, and let me take this to one other stretch, which is not going to sound good, but it's reality. If we would drone strike where the president of North Korea lives, and then they get another president that's out of his mind, and we drone strike that place, maybe potentially they get one that isn't, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know that sounds far-fetched, but it's really not. These drone strikes can be precise if you know where these people live, and that's why we do them. We intentionally do them. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't get killed as collateral damage, you know, or somebody innocent, but that's why we do drone strikes. They're specifically targeted for certain people or certain places.
One of the things, before we turn to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, one of the things that I was curious about last night were the primary results. And Senator McCain survived a primary fight. Marco Rubio survived a primary fight. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz survived a primary fight. Any surprises in the primary results from your perspective?
Well, as I, you know, originally I thought Debbie Wasserman Schultz would be in trouble. I mean, if anybody, frankly, should have been in trouble, it was her. I mean, the emails proved, you know, what she was doing, which everybody knew what she was doing anyway. And then the Bernie movement and Sanders and the money that poured in there against her. But as time went on, I started looking at these races about a week ago. Now, I think McCain could be in trouble. And I know it's Arizona, and I know they haven't had a Republican forever in a day. But I think McCain could be in worse trouble in the general election than he is in the primary. It became evident that they were going to win these primaries. The ones that lost, Chaka Fatah, Corrine Brown, for example, were both indicted.
Mm-hmm.
And so they lost their primaries. Otherwise, the establishment in all cases ruled.
So let's turn to Rubio and McCain. McCain is being opposed by a representative, a congressman in Arizona. You would suspect from afar, and I'm only looking at this as afar, once he got through the primary, he'd be golden. What's his problem in Arizona?
I think that his problem is just going to be the fact that, you know, they might have went with him in a primary, especially with a weak primary opponent. But in the general, and also if you have a weak Trump on the ticket, and McCain's been in a long time, and I know that's been used against him, and he won. But in the general election against a seasoned person running against him like another member, it's potentially he could have a rough time. I mean, probably if you want me to bet my card today, I'm going to bet on John McCain for November.
Would you bet on Marco Rubio as well?
Yes. For sure, Rubio. Right.
Is he having a in the general election, does he have any sort of roadblocks?
No, I just don't believe he does. You know, that primary, the Democratic candidate got in so much trouble, Alan Grayson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wife-beating thing, and yeah. Otherwise, Grayson probably would have won that.
Interesting. But Grayson is, how can I say this, gentle. He is strange, to say the least.
Oh, yes. Oh, I love a lot of members of Congress both sides of the aisle, but I can make a real strange list. I'm sure I'm on one of their strange lists, but I can make one out for you. Some real dandies. Anthony Weiner was on the top of that one.
Trump is off to Mexico. What's he going to do in Mexico?
You know, as a selfish human being, Trump as president would keep us so employed in the media for 4 years, just so employed. I'm not sure he would re-win, but it would keep us going. This is like so out of the blue. This is surreal. If he has an exit plan, and, you know, that's one of the problems we had in Iraq. We went in, we had no way out, no exit plan. If you're going to do a big deal in your life, have an exit plan. If Trump has one with the president of Mexico, this is going to be absolutely amazing. Hillary Clinton alludes to it being a publicity stunt, but this may very well turn out, as Trump started his campaign with Mexico, his whole boost might come from Mexico.
Do you think they have a deal in the works?
I think they could. Look, if Trump would go down there, he only has to do two things. Lay out a policy, which honestly I could lay one out to you right now about joint border stations. You sign up. If you don't sign up, then you are illegal. And Mexico focuses with America to get them out of the country because they wouldn't sign up for a path, you know, of citizenship. But the last words Donald Trump has to say as he shakes his hand is, look, I want to work with you. I want to do this humanely. I want this to work for both countries. But if you don't, you have to understand I've got to build the wall. That's all he's got to say.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Clinton now. The FBI is saying, according to CNN, that it's going to release the report on their investigation that has the notes in it as well. And there's some discussion that there are emails that relate to Benghazi. Is this still a problem for Clinton?
It is, because there were millions of pieces like a puzzle that the FBI had to put back together. Because if I delete emails but I sent them to you, they're out there in cyberspace somewhere. Those were gone. They've recreated these emails. So it's brand new batches is what we're... This is not the same old, vast right-wing conspiracy email theory. They're new ones. And they're out there. And some of them that we're told are going back to Benghazi that we didn't know before. But I think beyond that, I think the drip, drip, drip of the percolator on the Clinton Foundation is what is going to cause her severe heartburn prior to Election Day. I'm not saying it's silver bullets. If she was not running against Donald Trump, she might as well just get out of the race today.
Mm-hmm.
These would end her.
What I found interesting is today there was a opinion piece. Actually, it was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things that they pointed out is that if neither was running for president, neither would win. Because according to a national survey, 33% had positive views about Mrs. Clinton, only 24% about Mr. Trump, and neither had a healthy 35%, which is that, Bob, just to give that some perspective, we've never seen those numbers before. You know, the pre-2016 average for neither was 5.7%. It dipped as low as 3% in 84 and as high as 9%. In 92, the American public doesn't like these candidates.
When my unfavorables in the Democratic seat that I had, I was Republican, when my unfavorables would go to 16 to 17%, we got into a panic, okay? I would be having a nervous breakdown if I was Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I mean, they have numbers that no candidate wants to see. And the best thing going for Donald Trump is he's running against Hillary Clinton, and the best thing for her is she's running against him.
Let's go to some of the domestic issues we have. Chicago. Chicago and the murder rate in Chicago is absolutely alarming. What's driving that, and what can be done?
You know, there's another thing. Rahm Emanuel is the mayor, and I'm not trying to politicize this, but if this were a Republican mayor, he would be driven down the street, out of office, is what would happen. Somebody's got to get a handle on it. I guess I go back to the, I know this is a generic, but the Rudy Giuliani, when he kind of retook New York,
mm-hmm.
and I know that's debatable, and especially these days, maybe about law enforcement, but first they have to have, you know, good behavior, training, et cetera, the right way to do things in the law enforcement community. And they still might have some mistakes that have to be dealt with, you know, appropriately. But on top of it, though, you have to have police and you have to have patrolling, and it has to be beefed up, and they have to go after the criminal element. I mean, it's like a killing field there. So, I mean, they've got to take a very aggressive approach to it, but they can't do it by, you know, let's just condemn the police and have them be the problem. I mean, there's got to be a very, very aggressive program, and also maybe some rewards turning people in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A reward system to turn people in. Money can do a lot in that direction.
The last question I have is, some are howling at President Obama's decision to commute the sentences of 111 federal prisoners. Why are they howling?
You know, I don't know the details on all. I know he's commuting a lot of people. I don't know in regard to other presidents, but I think he's commuted a ton of people in 1 month. The one that the cases that are going to really be looked at heavily that caused the controversy are the crack cocaine cases. Now, when I was in prison, I sponsored a lot of guys that were drug dealers, so I know this is an issue I know about. And because Len Bias, the sports star, ingested powder cocaine, all of a sudden they went after crack cocaine, even though he died of a heart attack from powder cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden in the system, if you had crack cocaine versus a ton of powder cocaine, you could get a 15-year sentence, where with the powder you got four. So it was a disparity in drugs. It really was in sentencing. So the president commuted a guy that was 100 years plus 10 years probation after he got out. Literally, that's what it said. And he commuted it to 30 years. And the guy had trafficking charges. So that's where it'll be controversial. But sentencing-wise, honestly, the crack cocaine was just way overboard. It was a political answer to a sensitive situation of a basketball star that, got high profile when he died of drugs.
That's right, and the Boston Celtics were never the same because they had drafted Len Bias and with hopes of he being the next Michael Jordan.
I was in prison with a couple of the guys that sold him, by the way, the coke. And the one guy, Michael, told me, he said, we couldn't believe it. It was our unfortunate problem of selling coke to Bias. They didn't hold him down, and they were drug dealers, don't get me wrong, but they didn't hold him down and make him use it. So, the reaction, though, was, it was Len Bias. Oh, my goodness, we've got to go after these people, and it was crack cocaine. Sort of like somebody shoots somebody with a bow and arrow, and they go after everybody with a gun. It was bizarre the way they reacted.
Bob, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
That's Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Senator Tim Ash on the healthcare system here in Vermont. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me in our WDEV studios once again is State Senator Tim Ash, Chair of the Senate Finance Committee. As you know, the senator was on in the first hour. I asked him to stay over because we've had a lot of phone calls about the subject that we're talking about, which is our healthcare system here in Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We left our discussion talking about sort of the consolidation aspect of our healthcare system. Big hospitals gobbling up, I don't want to say that word, big hospitals acquiring smaller hospitals. And the question that I have is, where are we going? Are we exchanging the talk about single payer to a talk about a single provider?
Well, we are effectively moving in that direction. So for your listeners' benefit, they don't need to know all the details, but hospital spending in Vermont, when you factor in the 13 hospitals, approaches about $2.4 billion. The UVM Medical Center is about $1.2 or $1.3 billion. So it's roughly half of the state's hospital spending. So anytime it acquires any new in-state facilities, it's just becoming a very, very dominant player, even more so than it's been imagined in the past. Much of the proposed benefit is that UVM Medical Center is also a very sophisticated hospital in terms of the services it provides. And so when it combines forces with a smaller facility, there are, you can imagine pretty easily that there might be benefits in terms of management approaches to various conditions, illnesses, the utilization of specialists who might not be as easily accessed if you live in other parts of the state. So those are all many of the benefits. One of the problems is that as this acquisition mode has occurred, and it's not just in Vermont, but it's elsewhere, but as the acquisition mode has occurred, it hasn't been very deliberate from a policymaker's point of view. So as independent practices have been acquired by hospitals, and as hospitals have joined affiliations with larger hospitals, there hasn't been a very clearly articulated policy justification for it. And I would say that regulators and politicians have been slow to understand what the implications are. So a simple example of how this has real cost implications is that in the past, commercial insurance providers, take Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont, pay doctors a different amount if they work for one of the medical centers than they would if it was for an independent doctor providing services at their privately owned facility. Well, the moment that facility gets purchased by a hospital, the reimbursement goes up the next day. So I'm not making this, I kid you not. A service, let's say it was $100 on day one, and then day two, the letterhead changed on that doctor's stationery to be affiliated with an academic medical center, it might be $150. Nothing has changed about the system. There's no new devices, there's no new patient, there's no new doctor, but the payment has just gone up $50. There is no reason that that should be tolerated, and yet that was part of the culture. Just this past year, there was a bit of a brouhaha over Medicaid changing its reimbursement scheme and allowing for a so-called facility charge. So when they were making payments to doctors for certain services, because of this new formula, Medicaid decided they tacked on an additional facility charge on top of it. So again, same exact service being offered to a Vermont patient, and then without anything else about the system changing, Medicaid was just paying a premium on top of what it had always been paying. And so luckily we were able to snuff that baby out and reduce that expense. But that's one of those underlying real-world practical problems that are associated with these kinds of acquisitions.
We're speaking with Senator Tim Ashton. We're talking about healthcare because it has such an impact on Vermonters in terms of affordability, access, and quality. Plus, it has a huge impact on our economy. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We'll continue these discussions throughout the next few months because of what is happening in healthcare and how it impacts you. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Hey, I've heard a lot of people bring up issues, particularly the issue of personal responsibility. Tim, I've heard your concerns about what's driving cost, but I'm not hearing a solution. So let me give you my two cents as to what a solution might be. And in order to do that, we need to quickly look at why we got into this situation. Three issues came up that brought us to this point. One was children, not enough children were being covered. Too many people were going bankrupt. And in general, not enough people were being covered. So how do we fix that? Well, we begin by covering all children up to the age of 21, period, for all issues. No child should go without because of a parent's decision or their state of affairs. Secondly, from that point on, everybody would get preventative coverage. That includes your yearly visits, colonoscopies, mammograms, pap smears, all the natural issues that come up for patients. From that point on, the only other federal guarantee would be catastrophic coverage. And catastrophic coverage would be based upon your financial situation. Everybody pays in above the poverty line, but people who are making $100,000 a year, $200,000, $300,000, a million, whatever it is, would see increasingly higher deductibles versus someone only making $75,000 or $50,000 with a child or two children.
Paul, let me just sort of back you up here. This is Mike Smith. Let me sort of back you up here. What are you describing, and tell me if you are, because it's sounding like that, is a sort of Medicare for all with catastrophic being covered or hospitalization with the ability of the person to do a wraparound other than children up to the age of 21 and a free annual visit. Is that what you're describing?
Well, I'm getting there. And because basically what that does is it takes off the issue of people going bankrupt because of medical issues. It covers all children. So now we've taken care of two of the major issues that got us into the position we're in. And the third issue is we would have more people covered, period. So all the issues have now been addressed. Now the issue of cost comes into play. And the way we've cut that issue of cost is by allowing people with the higher deductibles to purchase supplemental insurance from private insurers. And here's the key, Tim. It has to be done without community rating, without guaranteed issue. Because at that point, we've already covered people. No one's going bankrupt. And that, in this particular case, we've now taken people's life choices into effect. If people are out of shape, smoking, obese, whatever it may be, yes, they should pay more if they want that supplemental insurance versus someone who is healthy, non-smoking, moderate drinking. So we're cutting cost, we're covering children, we're covering everybody, and I think costs would come down based on that system.
Thanks, Paul, for your phone call. Tim?
Well, Paul, no, I appreciate the suggestions, and I think that you rightly say, what do we do now? I mean, that's a question. It's much easier to identify problems than come up with solutions. One additional element that I would add to Paul's list of solutions is electing a Congress that actually develops the larger framework for methodical control of costs in our healthcare system. And they have the power to control costs of pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and other things, and to provide more befitting reimbursements in our Medicaid system. One of the challenges of Vermont's Medicaid system is it has an inverse relationship. The more services and more coverage we provide, we actually get a lower reimbursement rate from the federal government. So the better we do, the more we take care of our people, the federal government responds by providing less financial support. That's a real problem for us right now. And there are other states that we would not want to live in, which actually receive higher reimbursements from the feds. But thank you, Paul, and I will take those into consideration.
One of the things that I was fascinated by in the last sort of session that the Green Mountain Care Board had with UVM Medical Center was this discussion on cost shift. And the discussion was something that I've never heard. Does cost shift exist? And one of the things that UVM Medical Center was saying, that cost shift does exist, but some members of the Green Mountain Care Board said, no, you're not explaining this right. Do you think cost shift is a factor?
It's a fascinating issue because it has been an excuse in the healthcare industry for a long time to justify all sorts of problematic practices. In my opinion, whether you believe the cost shift is the explanation for all of our ills or not.
Let's explain the cost shift as it is sort of how people define, which is that people with insurance pay more in order to cover people that don't have insurance. Do I have it right?
Yes, and the logic goes that because government pays less than the cost to provide the service, someone else has to pick up the tab, and that's commercial insurance. Now, Medicare, which is a very big payer in the state of Vermont, they believe, and they have a formula set in Washington, that they actually pay what it costs to provide the service plus a little administrative overage to accommodate all the expenses that hospitals rightly incur. Many insurers and providers will say that's not true. Well, so we throw our hands up and say, well, we need a mediator for these two. But if there is a cost shift, or if there is not, in my opinion, it's hard to truly determine what the implications are for UVM Medical Center or any other hospital in the state if you don't know what the actual costs in the hospital are. So Alan Ramsey, who's one of the Green Mountain Care Board members, said, this is just an excuse that many hospitals use to avoid making tough decisions and keeping their costs down. Because if you don't have to do that, you can always justify increasing commercial rates by saying, well, we have to do it because we don't get enough money from the public payers. What Alan was suggesting is, no, maybe there's an alternative to raising prices for commercial policyholders, and that's to actually reduce your wasteful spending. That should be the first thing you do, not turning to people who have commercial insurance and asking them to pay more. I happen to believe that is this is where I use the word conservative to suggest that this is what people, regardless of party or ideology, should all agree. The first thing you want to do is make sure you're not spending more than you need to. Then worry about the distributional impacts after that.
Let's go back to the phone line. We've got busy phone lines here. Let's go to Bill in Barry. Bill, you're on open mic with Senator Tim Ash.
Good morning, gentlemen. Gail in Calais was correct. I got an example when she said we needed to have more tests that are important. Tests are cheaper than actually having to take care of the problem when it gets too serious. When I was in my early 50s, my primary care physician started testing me for a PSA test for prostate cancer. He saw that it was going up gradually, but it was going up. To make it short, 15 years later after he started, I had prostate cancer. But that's after three biopsies, two negative, and finally, in fact, we expected it. And it was like 7.8 or something when I had it. That was taken care of, and I'm still talking. I have like almost negligible my PSA. I know some people, friends of mine, who before they got tested, the first test was over 10. And some of them were even much higher than that. And they all cost more money for them to be cured, or in some cases, they weren't cured.
So the question I think you're asking, Bill, and that is, test can result in lower cost later on. And so how do you sort of balance the non-testing versus the implications of not performing that test later on?
Well, I think this is certainly an area where politicians should take a backseat to medical professionals. This is an ongoing debate now with breast cancer screening, with other types of cancers, where the medical profession has evolved its position about how frequently and at what age testing should be done. So anecdotally, I think, first off, I'm happy that the caller's health is where we wished it would be. But I don't think we want politicians meddling with the dials about, you know, who gets a test at what time frame. But as a system, we should certainly be making sure that our medical providers are following whatever the best thinking of the day is in their profession. Unquestionably, if you were to survey all of the doctors in the state who evaluate people for prostate cancer, my guess is there's some variation in when they test, how often they test, and so on. And yet the best practice is somewhere out there that the profession knows. So we don't want to be encouraging people to deviate from what are commonly best practices. On the other hand, politicians getting in the way of the doctor and the patient is something that I would be very nervous about.
Let's go to Steve in Hinesburg. Steve, you're on open mic with Senator Tim Ash. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I had an experience with you over a year and a half ago with the medical center. I used to go to the Hinesburg Family Health Services office down here, and the medical center bought them out, and I went in for a CDL physical. And I got a bill from the doctor that gave me the physical for $112, which I thought was fine. And then I got a bill from the medical center for $290-some-odd. And I didn't quite understand what it was, so I called the finance office, and they told me it was just the use of the new building. And I said, how can they charge me for just the use of that? Isn't the doctor, part of the doctor's bill included in that? And they said, the answer they gave me was, because they can. And I just thought that was outrageous. There was no place for me to turn to other than that. And plus, the Medicare or my insurance company wouldn't cover a bit of it.
Steve, thank you.
Yeah, this gets to the heart of the so-called facility charge, where a practice that is acquired by a medical center literally the next day will see an increase in the reimbursements or payments or charges because of these so-called facility charges. Now, of course, services that are provided to any provider within, say, the UVM Medical Center network need to have some additional cost to cover the operation of the emergency room, 24/7 emergency services, and so on. And they do provide services where they don't make much money, so they're trying to cover those costs in all the other things that they bill. But if, in the case of the Hinesburg family practice, They are acquired by the medical center, and a new charge is associated with that. The consumer should expect that that amount is lessened, that there's pressure relieved on all of the existing practices within the UVM network, so that they're just picking up their share, but it's not just adding new payments, because otherwise all we've done is just pumped more money into the system with no commensurate service or benefit or value. So we've been working on that, trying to reduce that out of the system. And I want to be clear, UVM Medical Center takes heat because they really are the only player of that scale in Vermont. They didn't create these schemes, and nor are they exploiting them in some malicious way. It's just one of those dysfunctions in the healthcare industry across the country. And here in Vermont, the question is, can we be one of the first states that tries to make some rationality out of this?
Can anybody decipher their bills anymore?
No way. Anybody who hasn't read The Bitter Pill by Stephen Brill, which appeared, it was an entire Time magazine, was taken up by this one article about 3 or 4 years ago now. And he worked with about 4 or 5 patients with different types of insurance, ranging from no insurance to government insurance to commercial insurance. And each of them had some very serious medical problem. And he took their whole collection of bills, some of which had accumulated over the course of months or even a couple years, and he tried to understand every line of all these bills. In the end, Stephen Brill, who founded Court TV and is quite a bright gentleman, could make no sense out of it. So he contacted the CEOs of the hospitals and said, can you justify these charges on the bills? They all said no. None of them could relate the charge on the bill to the actual cost to provide the service. And then the insurance company, which negotiates, and I am using air quotes for your listeners, a discount. The discount is a fictionally set percentage reduction on an artificially set charge. And then the patient is left paying some dollar amount, which is based on multiple layers of fictions. So if your listeners are struggling to understand their bills, that means they are rational, sensible people. Because if they could understand it, there's something wrong with them.
Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic with Senator Tim Ash. Good morning.
Good morning. Two real quick points here. One is, I think the Affordable Care Act has actually taken us down the correct road. It's, you know, with shared financial risk, the skin in the game concept, and the generally free routine maintenance performed at the doctor's offices. Unfortunately, politics has kept us from being able to revisit it, to fix it where fixing needs, or to improve upon it or make changes where it's needed. Which also brings me to the second point, which is people have called in about lifestyles and such. And politics has made a lot of people very distrustful of the government. But when you talk about things like obesity and some other eating habit-related diseases, it's the government that's been trying to inform us and educate us about a healthier food diet. And we see this, whether it's people attacking Michelle Obama and her vegetable gardens, or people attacking the food programs that are going on in our schools that are trying to teach our youngsters how to eat better and healthier food so that they don't grow up with these obesity problems. So a lot of this comes down to politics and what we as a society are willing to sit down and say, this is what we can work on together. And that's the heart of politics. And I think that's creating a lot of the problems we're looking at today.
Tim?
Rama, I think your point about the Affordable Care Act is an interesting one, because many aspects of the Affordable Care Act are very, very popular. But then when those same people polled to determine whether they support things like letting kids stay on their parents' plan until 26 and pre-existing conditions and so on, when they're asked about the Affordable Care Act, they don't like it. They just like everything in it. And, you know, the insurance industry has been an interesting industry to follow in this regard, because they're credited basically with writing the Affordable Care Act and then undermining it politically when they have the opportunity. I know, Mike, you were talking earlier about some states where the people are the insurers are fleeing the exchanges. Well, in many states, unlike Vermont, there are very few people taking up insurance through the exchanges, and so it's no wonder that they're not seeing a real ripe business opportunity. So the politics of it have really colored people's understanding of what's actually in the law. And, of course, as I said before, the world as we knew it before the Affordable Care Act, the world before Governor Shumlin took office and promised single payer, everything was not pretty. People were frustrated. They were mad. Blue Cross Blue Shield was persona non grata as an organization in this state. It's only because people have become more and more distrustful of many of the things that government touches, sometimes rightfully so, that they now believe that the single people they can trust are the insurers. And that's a major flip on its head of policy in the state.
I've only got about 5 minutes left here, and I want to get to the all-payer waiver. Players of chess will often think of moves that are not imminent, but down the way in terms of what moves they're going to make differently as you make a move. The all-payer waiver seems like a move that has ramifications throughout the healthcare system. Let's put aside for a minute that we've had sort of a bad experience with implementation of new sort of systems in this. But one of the things that it will do is it will disrupt the system as it is currently constituted. Is it worth it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's made more difficult by the fact that the negotiations that are occurring between the Green Mountain Care Board, the administration, and the people at the Centers for Medicare are mostly private. Much of what is occurring is not able to be shared with the public, making it hard for us to really understand what we're buying into. Interestingly enough, when you talk to primary care docs in the state of Vermont, when you talk to leaders of various hospitals, both large and small, they believe that there is a tremendous amount of promise of an all-payer model. What they believe is a predictable revenue stream coupled with some flexibility about how you manage people's health outcomes, that this could actually be the early stages of really flipping our system on its head so it's not fee-for-service and volume-driven. The risks are real too, though. One of the issues that I've always had is that you only want to lock in a predictable revenue stream if you think it's an expenditure stream, if you believe it's the appropriate amount of expenditure. So I'm not convinced we're spending the right amount today. In some areas, we spend too little. In many areas, we spend way too much. And so locking in a growth rate based on today's spending, to me, makes some assumptions about how much we spend today. But you make the point about chess. I would modify it. I would say good chess players see several moves out and try and anticipate the different moves. And what has made healthcare reform so challenging over the last 5 or 6 years is not knowing what will happen in the world around us. So in Washington, the outcome of this presidential and congressional elections might have a lot to do with whatever Vermont attempts in terms of its own healthcare agreements with the federal government. And so an all-payer agreement today is as good as the funding that is allocated by Washington. Typically, they live up to their agreements once they've signed them. But that's a risk that we don't know. The commercial insurers are less warm to this prospect. They have their own internal motivations, but I think they're also frustrated with some of the issues they face with Vermont Health Connect and wondering how this is really going to sugar out for them. But if we have our commercial insurers, in particular Blue Cross, nervous about the all-payer, that's something we should be worried about. How our Medicaid system factors into this, our Medicaid system, which is growing so fast, it's cannibalizing everything else in government, that's something we need to better get a handle on. And we have this explosion of a bubble, if you will, of people who will be retirement age with higher health expense in the future. And the question is, if we lock into an agreement with a growth rate, and then we find that the Vermont population, because of demographics, are costing more than we had expected, the financial risks might play out in ways that we're not really happy with. Some people think, oh, the risk is borne by the providers. Well, at a certain point, the only people who pay providers are businesses, families, and taxpayers. So there are risks involved, but we have to think, if we do nothing, what are the risks? And the risks there are that costs keep going up and we still have some access issues.
And what we're talking about is an all-payer waiver from the federal government where currently providers are paid and reimbursed for each service. And we would go to sort of, I guess I would explain it as a global budget, and the payment method would be managed is based upon how you manage the health of a population to that budget number. One of the things in this all-payer waiver is the formation of what are called, and I know there's a lot of acronyms here, what are called an accountable care organization or an ACO, which sort of centralizes the billing, the payment, the health data. Healthcare institutions would become part of this accountable care organizations. The worry among smaller institutions and practices is that the bigger players in this will control that ACO. How do we prevent that?
Well, one thing we have done is made very clear to the leaders of the affordable care organizations in Vermont that we want governance structures which ensure that the larger institutions can't control the outcome. Very similar to when the GMP-CVPS merger occurred in the electric industry. And we made sure that the VELCO board, which controls transmission of power throughout the state of Vermont, that it wouldn't be controlled by this new merged entity. So we had that same worry. And to the credit of the people who were the leaders of OneCare, which is Vermont's largest accountable care organization, they have created a board governance structure which ensures that non-UVM providers will have a majority on the board. So I think that helps put some checks in there. But an important issue, and this is to not dive too deep in the weeds, but one of the challenges is an accountable care organization is told to manage a population at a certain price. And it says if you can do it for a better price, you get to share some of the savings. The rest goes back to the payers. Well, if you have a number of providers, some small doctors, a big hospital, a small hospital, and in fact they do reduce expenditures to manage the population, the question is who gets the savings? Who takes the credit, if you will, for making me more healthy? And that is going to be one of the more contentious issues moving forward to make sure the right people are rewarded for the right interventions in public health.
I could go on all day about this, and it's because it's such an important issue. I want to thank you, Senator Tim Ash, for joining us today because this is an important issue. Thank you very much.
It's the most important issue. And in fact, if I were advising either candidate for governor, this would be the only issue they would talk about. It might not be fascinating to the public, but it's the most important issue facing them.
Thank you, Senator Tim Ash. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I just want to wrap up and talk about the reasons why we are spending so much time on health care. Today we spent almost the entire program on health care, and the reason is it's such a big deal. It's such a big deal to our callers, as you found out. We had lots of callers today, some that we didn't get on, and I apologize for that. But it also has a huge impact to our economy. I do want to thank our guest today, which is Senator Tim Ash, Senator from Chittenden County, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And the reason he was here for such a long time is because the Senate Finance Committee is responsible for healthcare finance in the Senate. Also, Bob Ney was on for an extended period of time, and I want to thank him. We talked about a lot of things, including why is Donald Trump going to Mexico. Tomorrow, a discussion about transgender athletes competing in high school sports with the Vermont Principals Association. And Brian Harwood will join us reminiscing about WDEV's 85th year anniversary. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barry.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.